Hey, it's Tim Slover from KUER. You like podcasts, right? I do. So this month, we're asking you to tell someone about a podcast you think they'll love. That could be your mom or a friend or, I don't know, someone who doesn't really get podcasts yet, anybody. You can pick whatever podcast you want. Maybe it's about music or politics, maybe cooking or Stranger Things fan theories or rodeo clowning or meditation. Just get a friend to listen. Remember to hit the share button and use the hashtag tripod. That's try with a Y followed by pod because of jokes. And thanks for getting the word out.
I'm very concerned if we don't pass this bill today that this will be an initiative.
If they don't listen to the will of the people will speak.
We can be reasonable. We can communicate. We can be respectful, we can be civil, we can find common ground.
And if our partners buckle under this political pressure, if the hard choices just become too hard, then we'll just keep moving forward.
Mr. Speaker, in conclusion, the $10 founding father without a father who got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter, by 14, they place him in charge of a trading charter.
Welcome to 45 Days, a KUER news podcast where we break down week by week the bills, lawmakers, and the events of the 2017 Utah legislative session. I'm Terry Gilday, KUER's news director, and I'm in studio this week with reporters Whitney Evans and Nicole Nixon. Hi.
Hi. Hi.
We're 6 weeks in to the 2017 legislative session. This is the last episode of 45 Days we'll have while the session's going on. When we come to you next Friday, it'll be after Sine Die on Thursday at midnight, and we'll wrap up the entire session with the entire KUER news staff. But this week, we want to focus on a couple of bills, and then we're going to have a speed round at the end of this episode and talk about a dozen pieces of legislation we've been covering, where they sit, whether we think they're going to make it through the session by next Thursday at midnight. But let's start with a bill that we have been waiting a long time to get our hands on. Nicole, this is HB 442. This is Representative Brad Wilson's alcohol amendments bill. This is the bill that could tear down the Zion Curtain. It's about 5,000 lines long. There's a lot going on here, and we've been waiting weeks to get our hands on this. You went to the hearing this week. What happened?
So it came out. It's 151 pages now that it's been changed a little bit. So it's taken me a little bit to go through it all. So this is the bill that could bring down the Zion curtains. Representative Wilson has worked it so that restaurants that are now grandfathered, meaning they don't have a Zion curtain, they were built before that law came around in 2009, will have three options now, and I'll let him explain those.
Restaurants will have three options. They can prepare and serve from a separated area. Basically our current separate storage and dispensing area. They can have a 10-foot buffer from the edge of the dispensing area to where minors can begin to sit, a buffer area. And the third option is what's done in some other states around the country, which is basically a half wall, delineating the difference or the separate areas of the dining room and what we call the dispensing area. And this 42-inch barrier, permanent barrier, will separate those two spaces so you know which part of the facility you're in, the restaurant area or the dispensing area.
Not confusing at all, right?
Is everyone still awake?
So to go through that again, if you restaurants will have three options. Every restaurant that serves alcohol will have to do this. So they'll have to have one, a Zion curtain. We all know what that is. Two is a 10-foot buffer zone, what's now being referred to as the Zion Moat.
Is that where you go in and if your blood alcohol level is above 0.05, you get eaten by an alligator?
We'll get to that. We'll get to that. Hold on. We're going to get to that bill.
So minors, children are not allowed in this 10-foot area surrounding a bar if there's no wall there. The other option would be to have a half wall that's 6 feet from the edge of the bar. It's 42 inches, about 3.5 feet high as all. That can be a railing, a short wall, or even I've heard decorative flower pots would work, as long as it's a permanent structure. So most restaurants seem to be okay with this compromise. It provides them a little bit bit more flexibility. Representative Wilson says that 15 states, including like Washington, Oregon, Pennsylvania, have some sort of law requiring a structure to separate the bar from where minors can sit. And there's been some controversy over what we're going to call this half wall. Wilson kind of wants it to be called the Washington State Wall, since that's the place he pulled
from.
Yeah. I've also seen the Zion Wall or the Zion Retaining Wall. So I guess we'll see.
Well, are we hearing from restaurants at all saying, you know, maybe this is a step forward and two steps back, because it's creating options, but people are still having to do something?
Yeah, I think most restaurants. So when the bill first came out on Monday, there was a lot of pushback from restaurants because it was this 10-foot buffer area or the Zion curtain, and they didn't think that that provided enough flexibility to restaurants. So Wilson went back, and this was the compromise, the third option of the 3.5-foot railing to separate the bar from the dining area. And restaurants seem, people in the restaurant industry seem to agree that this is more fair for everybody. It levels the playing field for restaurants that had to build the Zion curtain, and the older restaurants that have been off the hook because they were grandfathered into the Zion curtain in 2009.
So building this half wall, it doesn't seem to place the kind of burden upon restaurant owners that that the Zion curtain did, right?
It is. There's still a little bit of burden there, but I think people agree that it's not as burdensome.
And again, everyone would have to do this now, not just individuals who had a Zion curtain structure or some obstruction in their restaurant when they got a license and built a place after 2009. Every single restaurant that serves liquor in the state of Utah would have to have these would have to choose one of these three options now.
Exactly. And even restaurants that had to build the Zion curtain and they don't like it, they can take it down and they can institute one of these other two options.
I remember when the Zion curtain came about, the idea was that by having a visible place where cocktails are being mixed or liquor is being displayed somehow could in some way incentivize a young person to drink underage. And so what happened with that idea? Because now it seems with these new provisions, if you choose the retaining area or the half wall or the railing or the permanent flower pots, now you can display your liquor on the back wall. Now you'll see bartenders mixing cocktails. Is there any concern about the visibility of cocktails being mixed?
There is still some. A couple conservative groups spoke against this because they like the Zion curtain. They say that it does a good job of shielding children from seeing alcohol. But, you know, lawmakers voted overwhelmingly in favor of this bill as it is now on the House Business and Labor Committee. So I think that people think that this is a good trade-off.
Herbert had his media availability on Thursday where he talked about this bill and said that he thinks it's a good idea to give restaurants options. He was sort of noncommittal on whether he totally approves of the bill or not, but what he did say is he likes that we're giving restaurants options. He thought that the whole idea of grandfathering was unequal to some businesses. Mm-hmm. Because you're putting businesses on different playing fields, and he didn't like that. But he also did mention this idea that when kids see alcohol being mixed and being poured, it somehow makes them want to drink alcohol. He said there's no data to show that.
I've always wondered why people focus and hone in on alcohol being mixed. When you go to a restaurant like Applebee's, they've got those drink menus full of the very colorful, delicious-looking drinks. And as a kid, I always went and sat down and would grab the menu and look through it and go, this one looks good, even though I knew they were alcoholic and I wasn't allowed to have one. So this bill, besides having those new grandfathering options, would do several other things. It would change some licenses. So the social club license now would convert to a bar license, and I don't think there are any other changes there. Some restaurants have dining club licenses right now. Those restaurants would be required to choose to convert to a full-service restaurant license or a bar license, and there are some changes there with requirements of food sales versus alcohol sales. This is the other thing some restaurants were concerned over. For example, somebody who owns the Bout Time Pub and Grub Sports Bars, there are 10 locations in Utah. He came up and was worried about having to switch to either a restaurant license or a bar license. He gave the example that zoning for their location in Holiday does not allow for a bar. So he wanted some help from the state as well as time to work with cities on zoning issues.
So getting out of the restaurant realm, there's some other trade-offs in this bill. We're talking about a 2% markup from 86% to 88% on liquor sales, right?
Yep.
What are some of the other trade-offs?
So this is a big one, too, a 2% markup on all alcohol, liquor, wine, and beer would obviously increase the price if you want to go to a bar or a restaurant and get a drink. This markup is supposed to bring in about $4 million a year to help pay for increased trainings for servers and managers, as well as underage drinking prevention programs for 8th graders and 10th graders. For 10th grade students, that would focus on the dangers of drunk driving. For 8th grade students, that program would focus on preventing underage drinking. I'm guessing that's like having students learn the risks associated with alcohol and learning how to say no, things like that. There were a couple other things. There are, again, increased training for managers and employees. The Department of Public Safety would be instructed to keep track of all the restaurants that have a violation or serve alcohol to minors, increased tracking there.
I understand Representative Wilson also talked about labeling in stores and positioning a product in stores, right?
Exactly. So this was a big issue also. If you go to the grocery store or gas station right now, you might see displays of the malt beverages. Those are the things like the apple ale, the hard lemonades and sodas. These are beverages with 3.2% alcohol, just like light beer. Wilson says there are some problems with these not being labeled adequately enough as alcoholic beverages. He brought some examples to show lawmakers of a root beer flavored alcoholic beverage that you can buy at the grocery store, and he told everybody a story about those.
I had someone in my office a few weeks ago say that her mother over the holidays accidentally bought some of that when she was buying some other product and thought it was just root beer, because it wasn't signed differently in the store she bought it in, and served it to her grandchildren over the Christmas holiday. So we've got to kind of do a better job of making sure if people are buying alcohol, they know they're buying it from a section that has alcohol.
So this provision would make the requirements for labeling those alcopops, as they're called, in flavored beers stricter to try to prevent that confusion. It would restrict the number of displays in, like, grocery stores to only two so that they're not scattered around the store and set up next to produce and things like that.
Great. So the bill passed out of committee. We have only a few days in the session left, so I'm assuming this is going to hit the House floor very quickly.
Yeah, I think so. I think it'll get up there pretty quickly. They want to move it through fast and get it through the Senate. Wilson said that this bill is not set in stone. It may see a few more tweaks as it goes through to the House floor and the Senate.
Okay, we'll keep our eyes on it in the final day of the session. Let's move on to another bill, Whitney, that you covered this week, HB 239, Juvenile Justice Amendments. This is Representative Lowry Snow, his bill in the House, and Senator Todd Weiler is the floor sponsor in the Senate. This would create standards to help keep juveniles out of detention. Tell us what this is about.
I think this bill, first of all, slipped under the radar a little bit because of all the fun alcohol bills that are out right now. But it's very, very important, just like Utah decided to take a look at reforming the criminal justice system on the adult level in 2015. This is a bill that would overhaul the juvenile justice system. It limits the time a juvenile can spend in detention. The average time right now is 3 years, and it caps fees and service hours a judge can order. And it initially required counties to provide attorneys for juveniles charged criminally. Snow took that out later in the process because counties said they couldn't afford it. So that's just a little bit about what this does. The argument is that keeping a juvenile in the home costs obviously a lot less than sending them to a secure or non-secure facility. Snow says it's going to save the state $12 million a year, but there's an upfront cost to the tune of about $3 million a year. A lot of these kids go to juvenile detention for things like truancy, and once they get there, they're not separated from kids who've committed a lot of other scarier crimes like rape and attempted murder, like criminals are on the adult level. So they're really getting in trouble for these low-level offenses, and they're locked up, and then they get sort of in deeper with these more dangerous offenders. And Republican Representative Eric Hutchings, who sponsored the adult criminal justice reforms in 2015, he's a big supporter of this bill.
We are sending kids off to incarceration and putting them into circumstances that we now know for a fact actually makes them worse. This isn't a maybe, this isn't a sort of. We have a current legal system that creates criminals out of young kids. We do. We know it. We're trying to change that.
So Representative Snow has experience as a prosecutor. How did that inform this bill and how he wrote it?
Well, he said that he was a prosecutor on both the adult and juvenile side, and he, in that experience, I think he found a lot of sympathy and empathy for these people and what they were going through. And he just saw that a lot of these young people were sort of getting a raw deal, because they would, you know, a judge would say, well, I'm going to order you to go to school. And the kid would violate that court order, would not go to school, and then would be placed in detention. And he just thought that was a little bit excessive. So he told me, you know, just he wants to help these kids. He spent a lot of time with these kids and their parents. So he has a lot of empathy and sympathy for them.
And so the bill passed out of the House 68-7 with some bipartisan support. It's now going to be headed to the Senate. We, again, have a limited time left in the session. How important is this bill, Whitney, and you think it's going to have any opposition in the Senate moving forward?
It's very important. Snow says, you know, it's not, he won't go as far as to say the juvenile justice system is broken, but he says we've got to change the status quo because it's not working. This is another example of our elected officials matching the right size solution to the right size problem. We saw this happening with the adult criminal justice reforms and even on issues like homelessness. Again, we're seeing that it's more expensive and less effective to just warehouse people than it is to pinpoint their problems and address those problems initially. I think that both Republicans and Democrats in the House and Senate see that as an important step. And I think they see this as something that needs to be done. And they've dropped the fiscal note. It was initially $9 million to $3 million. So I think that's going to be a big help.
Okay, we'll keep our eyes on it. Let's talk briefly about another bill, Whitney, that you covered late this week. This is HB 259. This is called Duty to Retreat Amendments. Representative Corey Malloy, this bill, I'm going to quote some language that's pulled from the top of the bill here. It says, this bill clarifies that a person is not required to retreat from an aggressor. This is sort of clarifies stand your ground policies in Utah. Tell us a little bit more about this.
Well, the bill says if you're being attacked, you can use deadly force without fear of a judge or jury saying, well, you could have run away, your use of force was unreasonable, and potentially charge you with a crime. This basically forbids courts from considering convicting people who were trying to defend themselves. And two Democrats on the House floor were the only two people to oppose the bill. It was Representative Karen Kwan and Representative Rebecca Chavez-Houck. Representative Kwan said people could be mistaken for being a threat because they are, quote unquote, brown. She worries it would increase fear and concern that communities sort of already have around gun violence. Representative Rebecca Chavez-Houck used her own Latino son as an example of how this could go wrong. She brought up the idea of implicit bias, which is almost like sort of a subconscious racism that people feel when they're just not around people of color, or they just see the way people of color are portrayed in the media.
Those situations where there is aggravated concern, aggravated adrenaline because of a tense situation and perceived threat, those are things that are real for many in our community and many of our people of color. When you have your own child come home and say, I was asked to leave a store because one of the people came to me, one of the clerks came to me and said, you're making our customers feel nervous. Implicit bias is real.
Really powerful piece of tape there. Obviously very sort of an upsetting idea, but this is definitely a concern that that some people have, particularly Democrats. It passed 53-15, mostly along party lines. A couple of Republicans threw in a no vote there.
Also, You said, sir, the language in the bill means that if you're being attacked, that you can use deadly force to defend yourself. I wondered, has anybody unpacked on the House floor or in discussions about this bill what being attacked means? Does it mean you have to, someone's charging you with a deadly weapon, someone is using their hands in a hand-to-hand combat kind of force way that is considered deadly? That seems to be the variable for me here. Like, what does that mean?
From what I've heard, it sounds like if you feel like you're under threat, if you feel like someone is threatening your life, you can use deadly force against them, and a court cannot say, a judge or a jury cannot say, well, you didn't try your hardest to get out of that situation before pulling a gun.
So it's a subjective thing. If someone's coming at me and I feel like my life is in danger, I can use deadly force.
That's how it seems.
Yeah, yeah. We'll keep an eye on this bill. Passed out of the House, do you think it's going to have any opposition in the Senate here in the last several days of the session?
Well, it passed 53-15, like I said, in the House, and I haven't heard anything out of the Senate about any strong opposition. And we haven't yet heard Governor Herbert's take on this bill yet. So it's anyone's guess.
Okay. We finally come to my favorite part of this week's podcast, the speed round. So we're going to go through a bunch of bills real fast. I'm going to poll Nicole and Whitney on whether they think they're going to pass or fail. So let's start with HB 237. This is firearms and domestic violence amendments. This is Lee Perry's bill that would do away with concealed carry permits while stepping up all kinds of provisions to prevent domestic violence. It tied in committee, went back to committee, went through committee in the House, passed 55-28 in the House, and now it's stuck in Senate rules. Is this going to make it through?
I don't think it will. I've heard that the sponsors are killing it because the NRA has lobbied so hard against it because the NRA does not like the provisions dealing with domestic violence. So I've heard that it won't make it out of Senate rules.
And as I like to call it, the bill that wants to please everyone will please no one and won't make it through. Let's go to HB 93, Judicial Nominating Process Amendments, Representative Merrill Nelson. This would drop race and gender as considerations in the process for filling judicial vacancies. This passed the House, but I think it got stuck in a Senate committee, right?
Failed to move forward in Senate committee, and we have no reason to believe that it's going to come back at this point.
Okay, here we go. Another alcohol bill, HB 155, Driving Under the Influence and Public Safety Revisions. This is Representative Norm Thurston's bill. This will drop the legal intoxication limit in Utah from 0.08 to 0.05. If this passes, Utah would become the first state to take on that BAC level. Many countries around the world, including Australia and countries in Europe, have this standard. This passed the House and moved out of a Senate committee, and it's on the second reading calendar of the Senate.
A lot of people like it.
Yeah, they do.
And it's not gotten a lot of pushback. I think it's going to get through. I don't know where the governor's going to be on it. He said he said BAC levels don't matter as much as whether or not you're impaired. The only reason cops can stop you if you are driving is because they think you're impaired or they have some other reason to stop you. So he says it's more about whether you're driving impaired, less about BAC. But like I said, everyone likes it.
Well, we've heard a lot about this bill. We had actually Representative Norman Thurston brought in a person from the National Transportation Safety Board this week, and she gave some compelling testimony in a Senate committee about how this saves lives around the world. We also heard from members of the brewing industry in a report by KUBR's Eric Newman. He had Steve Mills, who's the CEO of Uinta Brewing, in his story, talking about how this continues to stigmatize Utah, and it could hurt both tourism and the brewing industry here, and that people who consume alcohol responsibly feel like they're under attack. So, a lot at stake with this bill. I think it's gonna move forward, knowing the culture in this state, but we'll see. And again, don't want to minimize what's happening with people who drive intoxicated and in danger and take other people's lives irresponsibly. But it'll be interesting to see what happens with this bill. Real quickly, I want to touch on a couple of resolutions in the House. These have been signed by the governor. This is House Concurrent Resolution 12 and House Concurrent Resolution 11. These are the monument resolutions. One is asking President Trump to rescind the Bears Ears National Monument. Another is asking Congress to modify the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. Both of these were pushed through the chambers quickly. The governor has signed them. And now maybe the Utah congressional delegation can get the attention of the president or use some kind of congressional action to move forward on those public lands issues. The big takeaway from these is that they've alienated the Outdoor Industry Association and more than likely outdoor retailers is gone. We've talked a lot about that on this podcast. Moving on, HB 11, really important one. State boards and commissions amendments. This is, again, Norm Thurston. This would remove the political party requirement from certain state boards and commissions. This is all but to the governor's desk right now. This has passed both chambers. They've reconciled a little bit. According to the legislative website, it says that a draft of the enroll bill is being prepared. What do you think? Is this going to happen?
I think it's hard to say. I think we'll just have to wait and see what Governor Herbert does with it.
He's still looking at it. I know I spoke to some of his spokespeople the other day who said that it's a little different from when it was initially introduced. Some commissions were taken out. Commissions were put back in. And so he has to look at this sort of revised version of what it initially was. And I don't know. There's been a lot of pushback to this from a number of levels.
Is there a possibility for a veto here? I mean, Governor Herbert doesn't talk about his vetoes before they happen. I've been here 6 years, and I can't remember that the legislature has moved to override one of Governor Herbert's vetoes, even if it appears on paper they have the vote. So, but I'm wondering if this might be a potential veto.
Support came out of his office initially for this bill in its infant stage. So it's kind of hard to say whether he'll veto it or not. But just because of all the pushback that he's gotten from the public on this, or that the legislature's gotten from the public on this, it could be enough to sway him and make him decide to use his veto pen.
We'll see. Okay, let's move on to the two bills that represent some kind of movement potentially on medical marijuana. This is HB 130. This is cannabinoid research. Representative Brad Don, Senator Evan Vickers, and then the SB 211. This is the Cannabinoid Product Act, Senator Vickers. So one of these bills would allow for research of medical marijuana and medical marijuana products. The other bill would allow for the cultivation, use, and distribution of marijuana for the purposes of research. These are the bills that are sort of the placeholders for the medical marijuana movement. The lawmakers came out early in the session and said, we're not actually going to pass any kind of real medical marijuana legislation that puts marijuana in the hands of patients who need it for their use at their discretion. This is a step-by-step process, and we're going to make the product available to researchers and allow for research to happen. So these are moving along. One is stuck on the Senate third reading calendar. One has passed the House and is on the Senate third reading calendar as well. Do you think we're going to move on these?
I don't see why not. The legislature for several years now has said that they support continued research on the effects of medical cannabis.
Some of the most conservative lawmakers support researching this and the eventual legalization of medical marijuana. So I don't see, like Nicole said, any reason why they would not support further study.
Except for lack of time.
Except for lack of time. And we've also heard President Trump's press secretary, Sean Spicer, come out in favor of medical marijuana, but against recreational marijuana. And so we'll wonder if Attorney General Jeff Sessions could move on that. That might influence in some indirect way where medical marijuana is headed in the state. Okay, last bill in our speed round, another really important one, HB 99. These are bigamy offense amendments. This is Representative Mike Noel. This would make bigamy a third-degree felony, a second-degree felony when connected to the abuse of a child. This passed out of the House. It's stuck in the Senate Rules Committee. Any intel on that? Do we know if this is going to make it through?
It's a controversial bill. It's had a lot of debate in the House, in two committee meetings and on the House floor. I'm sure Mike Noel is working very hard to get it out of Senate Rules, but I'm not sure what's going on behind the scenes there.
Okay, great. Well, we'll keep our eyes on it. Stick with KUER News next week, as our entire newsroom will be up at the legislature covering the legislative session through midnight on Thursday, March 9th. We'll be back to you next Friday with the entire newsroom on the podcast, giving you a wrap-up of the entire 45-day session. Joining me in studio today are Whitney Evans and Nicole Nixon. Thanks.
Thanks. Thank you.
45 Days is a production of KUER News. JT Nebaker composed our music. Tim Slover and I produced the episode. I'm Terry Gilday.